Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Conversations this week with Kim Epifano, choreographer and director of Epiphany Dance Theater, about the 15th anniversary edition, 15th anniversary of the San Francisco Trolley Dances happening next weekend. She'll be joined by Kimi Okada, one of the choreographers, with created a site-specific piece for Mission Creek Park. From the upcoming ACT production of the play Men on Boats, we'll meet with director Tamela Woodard and actress Catherine Romans. Men on Boats is based on the 1869 expedition of the Colorado River and the Grand Canyon following Major John Wesley Powell and his crew of volunteers who charted the river. It's an interesting take on it, as it has neither men, boats, nor rivers involved. You'll learn more shortly. Also on the gender bending front, I'll talk with choreographer and performer Monique Jenkinson about Girl, her evening-length collaboration between her drag queen persona, Phonique, and her real-life husband and electronic composer, Mark Kate. Plus, Open Air's regular contributor and critic-at-large Peter Robinson talks with Irish author Paul Muldoon about the third annual Irish Arts and Writers Festival, during which 15 Irish authors, artists, and poets descend on the Bay Area to showcase the best in contemporary Irish arts and literature. Stay with us. ACT is putting on a 21st century theatrical spin on 19th century American explorer and one-armed Civil War veteran John Wesley Powell and his brawny and eclectic band of men, soldiers, trappers, and adventurers who explored Wyoming's waterways. It's a story that was inspired by his actual travel log from 1869. But this ingenious script by Jacqueline Bockhaus contains neither men, women, men, boats, or rivers. Here to talk about Men on Boats is director Tamela Woodard. Tamela is a co-founder of Pop-Up Theatrics and artistic director of the Five Boroughs, One City Initiative at Working Theater. Catherine Romans is in the program, MFA program at ACT, whose credits also include the Livermore Shakespeare Festival's production of The Importance of Being Earnest. Welcome, Catherine. Welcome, Tamela.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Well, this is this kind of puts all kinds of things on end, doesn't it? Tamela, when did you first come across this incredible story, the script of Jack Bockhaus?
The play made a big splash in New York just a couple of seasons ago at Club Thumb, and everybody I know was talking about it. And then I got a call from Pam McKinnon, who's the new artistic director here at ACT, that asked if I would be interested in talking about this play, and I was sort of like, I love that play. I would be very interested in talking about that play. Uh-huh. So I've known about the play itself since, I guess, it began, and have been a fan of it and just really feel very lucky to be able to get my hands on it.
So you're giving it your own spin.
We're, as an ensemble, as a company, giving it a good spin, yes, for sure.
Catherine, this must be quite an experience for you coming on board this show as well.
Yeah, definitely. Being an MFA student, we get the opportunity in our second year to audition for the shows in the next season. And if we are fortunate enough to get cast, we get to do it. So it is incredibly exciting for me to get to work alongside these very talented, seasoned San Francisco actors.
Tell us a little bit about your character, and then we'll dissect the story a little bit.
Sure. I am playing George Young Bradley, the youngest member of the expedition. He is 19 years old and very enthusiastic and excited to be brought along the journey, not unlike how I feel in this process.
Typecasting, so to speak.
Yes, very much so.
But of a different gender.
Yeah, that is definitely true.
So, Tamela, this is an all-woman production of a historic event, but how is the history incorporated into offering it to the public in a slightly different way?
Well, Jacqueline has ingeniously taken this journal of John Wesley Powell, which is actually quite exciting of a read. And he's a little poetic in his description of the perils of the journey and the successes along the way. And she has woven together a tale that exists between the rivers and the campsite, where we follow this company of people who are, I think, ultimately hoping to make history. You know, they're charting an uncharted land. They are endorsed by the government. It is just post Civil War. There's a kind of putting back togetherness of the country and an opportunity to reinvestigate the identity of the country and who you are as a citizen of that. And I think Jacqueline has put forward a very pure adventure where there are people who are entering into a landscape, into a frontier, hoping to discover something new, not just about the land around them, about themselves also.
Mm-hmm. And it's strikes a particularly contemporary chord, having an all-female cast.
I think the point or the invitation to the audience is to say, you know, this story of adventure belongs to all of us. And it's not a trick. It's not a kind of, like, crafty thing. It is a way of opening up the narrative to show, I think, or to demonstrate, or to invite people to see that this space can be occupied in other ways, and that the truthfulness of the story, the strength of the story, remains, and in some ways, I think, is even more illuminated.
And it goes beyond a particular gender.
Absolutely. Oh. It does.
Mm-hmm. So if we're not going to be seeing rivers or boats, what will we be seeing on stage?
Well, we won't put the rivers or the boats, but I think you'll see the rivers and the boats by the time we're finished with you. We're inviting people back to their active imaginations. And, you know, I think that the theater is one of the few places left where all the things that are possible are not right in front of you, where you yourself have to lean into the story. And, you know, you can bring back that five-year-old who can, you know, who could fly, that five-year-old who absolutely saw the tooth fairy, that five-year-old who, you know, whose imagination was unhampered by sort of being the socialized world. And that's what we get to do in the theater all the time. So this play absolutely does that.
So you obviously are very familiar with the play. Did you go to some of the source material of Powell's?
Oh, yeah. I dug all the way in and all down those rabbit holes, yes. Not only did I read Powell's journals, but I also read the journals that have now been recovered from some of the other people who were on the expedition. Oh. And it's so interesting, because one of the things that the play does very well is helps us understand that the story that's being told is the point of view of the storyteller. You know, it's not a story that represents all of these men's experiences, though Powell puts forth all of their experiences. When I read the other journals, the other folks on the expedition have very different points of view of how these events unfolded, and even of each other, than Powell put forth in his journals. Young Bradley is not so young and not so eager in his own journals. But to Powell, it was an opportunity to be a mentor.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is being billed as a hilarious, laugh-out-loud theater. Is that that sense of humor coming just from the switching of genders?
No, in fact, none of it comes from the switching of genders.
Interesting, okay.
The comedy comes from the writing. It's Jacqueline made a very funny play. And
so how is it being funny then?
Oh, well, I mean, comedy, you know, say comedy and tragedy are different masks from each other. The same mass, different sides. It's because we've taken a situation and dialed it up all the way to its absolute
11
extreme.
Or something.
Yes, and the dial up is not because these men are actually in a life and death situation from the moment they get on the river, and we are putting forward the life and deathness of that river every single time. And sometimes Tara can be, you know, funny. We know when, you know, when the mouse comes scraying out of the from the couch, that's pretty funny when you jump up in the air. And, you know. So we're just doing what normal humans do. We just turn the volume up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, talk a little bit about your interaction with your fellow actors in this play.
Sure. I think the in terms of the exploration of this play and what we've discovered, I think what Tamala is saying is exactly true. The comedy and the truth of the story only comes from playing the extreme sides of what is a life and death situation every single moment on the rapids, the campsite, the things that you encounter. And the second that we embrace those circumstances fully, the whole world of the play, the rapids, the trees, the beauty of the Grand Canyon, which is what they discover along the way, becomes alive. So the ensemble, we are all in it the whole time together, seeing it. And when you kind of get that pulse going, it's pretty incredible.
It's interesting. I just thought of an analogy that this was the moonshot of 1869, really. This kind of an
it
exploration.
Was. Yes. It was. There was
100 years later, the moon, 100 years before the Colorado
River. A feeling of,
River.
Yeah. I mean, what's next? Oh, we're up for the next one, aren't we?
like to send someone to the moon, but yeah. Interesting. So tell us a little bit about the rest of your cast. We have the wonderful Catherine Romans here.
Yeah, we've got, I think, a few Bay Area favorites that are in our cast, and I think you get to see them do some things that they haven't done before, or certainly not the extreme that they've done before. Amy Lizardo and Liz Sklar, I think, are pretty well known in and about. Rosie Hallett, Lisa Hora Garcia. Libby King is new to the area and is actually a friend of Jacqueline, and I'm a big admirer of Libby, so I was super happy that she was able to come and join our cast. Arwen Anderson, Emery Rojala, Sarita Ocon, all of these are Lauren Spencer. They're all just fantastic performers and have made a really stellar ensemble.
Mm-hmm. Some of the creative team includes Nina Bell, scenic designer, Christine Crook, costume designer, Robert Hand, lighting designer, and Kate Marvin, sound designer. Sounds like a wonderful cast of characters all around.
Oh, yeah.
In addition to the performances, you should be aware that there's some there are interactive events that ACT presents, including Bike to the Theater Night next Wednesday, the 17th. There'd be some safe bike parking provided. On the 30th, before the curtain goes up, you can have a prologue and take a look at the artistic process and a pre-show discussion with the director and artistic staff. And then there are audience exchanges on the 6th and 25th and the 28th of November. And Out with ACT on Wednesday, November 7th, the best LGBT night in town. Catherine Romans, rack up those credits. Let's see you again next time we and continued good luck with your degree at ACT. And Tamala, looking forward to the show.
Thank you.
The Men in Boats, that has neither men nor boats, runs at ACT's Strand Theater on Market Street through December 16th. Information at act-sf.org/boats. Thanks again for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Still to come, Peter Robinson will be talking with Irish author Paul Muldoon about the third annual Irish Arts and Writers Festival. And we'll also hear from Phonique, Monique Jenkinson's drag persona, in her performance at the Joe Good Annex. Next, we're going to talk about the 15th incarnation of the San Francisco Trolley Dances next weekend. This year's route travels along the N. Judah Muni line from Mission Creek Park to the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. Many dancers are involved, and I'm very pleased to be joined by Kem Epifano, who has a 30-year history as an award-winning choreographer, director, performer, vocalist, educator, and collaborator. She founded Epiphany Productions in 1997, and her works have been presented around the globe. In 2004, she launched the celebrated San Francisco Trolley Dances, an annual outdoor festival produced by Epiphany, featuring very site-specific dances by local choreographers. It's now one of the biggest city's biggest cultural events. Kim, always a pleasure to have you back to talk about this.
Thank you. I love coming here.
And Kimi Okada is a founding member of ODC. Her work includes more than 30 choreographed works for the flagship company ODC Dance. She's also choreographed productions for ACT, Yale Rep, the New Victory in New York, as well as Berkeley Rep, the Santa Fe Opera, and LA Opera, among many others. She was nominated for a Tony Award for the production of Largely New York. In addition to her work as a choreographer, Kimi also serves as director of the ODC School, which offers more than 200 classes a week in a broad range of dance styles. Kimi, welcome to you.
Hello, glad to be here.
Kim, 15 years of doing it. That's just astounding.
It is.
Tell us a little bit about the dancers that were selected for this year's incarnation.
Well, this year we have Kimi Okada at Mission Creek. And she's doing a dance with dogs and dancers. You can ask her about that.
I will. Okay. Say no more on that one. Yeah.
And then we also have Halau Makana Polynesian Cultural Arts. They're doing a piece at Mission Creek on the water also. Gene Isaacs from San Diego Dance Theater, who started San Diego Trolley Dances 20 years ago. I brought her up, and she's going to be in Mercy Housing, the senior center there right at Mission Creek.
Is the Trolley Dances in other towns than San Diego now, too?
Yeah, it's over in Riverside. I'm not sure if there's any more of them. But I was just down there and did a piece for Jean's Trolley Dances in San Diego. So I performed for her down there this year. I just got back. Robert Moses Kinn is doing a work, Asan Hassan Dancers, Steamroller Dance Company, and my troupe, Epiphany Dance Theater, will be at SF MoMA.
Mm-hmm. And for those that aren't familiar with this, this really exposes people who, unexpectedly, there you go, there's something happening there. What's going on?
Yeah. So we really connect neighborhood to neighborhood via the Muni. And you get to see incredible dances. They're all different short pieces along a trolley route, and we take you on a two-hour tour. And you might be inside, you might be outside. And I like to mix different kinds of dance, from traditional to postmodern, theater, music. I love live music. So it's you'll see each site is unto itself. And special. It's like a treasure hunt.
Mm-hmm. And involving dogs with Kimi. That's a great, great segue. Thanks, Kim. So, Kimi, talk about your work.
I am doing a piece with the company, ODC Dance, and I guess I should just speak about the genesis of it a little bit. I experienced a tragic loss of my husband partner of over 35 years in the spring.
Oh,
and
sorry.
And Kim asked me shortly after that if I was interested in doing a piece for Trolley Dances. And I thought, oh, how can I possibly make something now when I'm going through such a sorrowful period? And she took me to all the sites. I agreed to go look at the sites, and there were a lot of them downtown and here and there. And the last place that we went was the Mission Creek Park. And I felt from that site that, oh, maybe I could do something here because it was beautiful. There was water. There was a big mound. There was a meadow. And I thought I could possibly do a piece that is a tribute to everything and everyone that has helped me through a very sorrowful period. And so the piece is called Gifts of Solace, and it is really a tribute to my friends, my family, and to dogs. I have a dog. I have a 13-year-old border collie.
There's a lot of comfort there,
named
I'm sure.
Manju. And the actual act of having to walk him every day, of having to get outside of the house, of the huge show of support that I had from my dog owner friends from the dog parks that I went to every day, many of whom are actually in the piece. it was just such an outpouring of a community of support and love, and they banded together and gave me presents and walked my dog. And, I felt like it helped me through a very difficult personal time to have this community of dogs. So I thought, okay, I'm in a meadow, I'm outside, we're in Mission Creek. I could do a piece with dogs in it. So I'm a huge dog lover, and I thought, okay, how could I possibly do this as an homage to the unconditional love of dogs and the support of a dog community? So the piece is in two parts. The first part takes place on a big hill that we call the Mound. That it does not have dogs in it. It's called The Wind at Your Back. And that is really about using the hill as kind of a metaphor of getting through life, continuing. And then the second part is called Canine Comfort, and that has two dog pieces. One is a duet for one of the dancers, Natasha, and her great Aussie Howard, with the dancers in the background. And then the last section is using teams of dogs that do geometric formations that walk through the ODC professional dancers as they're doing a lot of dancing. And so I tried to keep the dog part fairly simple. I have three teams of dogs. There are 15 dogs.
There's only so many moves you can teach them, right?
Exactly. Well, I tried to keep, you know, I wasn't looking for circus trick trained dogs. I was really looking for
sit
you know,
and stay
dog,
would be helpful.
Yeah, dogs. So they had to be able to sit on command. They had to be able to walk on leash. They had to be able to be quiet and not bark with a lot of activity going around them.
No chorus lines, though.
No chorus lines. We had what we jokingly called the dog-dition, where we had 16 dogs show up at the park, and we just put them through a lot of walking patterns, and, you know, I didn't reject any of them, actually.
Oh, they all made it.
Kim, is this the first time that animals have been involved in the production?
Yes, I believe so. I'm so excited that it's happening.
Starting a trend, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I know there's been other people that maybe have done animals in theaters and whatnot, but not in trolley dances.
Well, I always say never perform with animals, but, you know, it's been really a wonderful thing. There's something about the dogs that they're so in the present. And when they come to rehearsal, they're just wanting to please. And they, you know, they're with their owners. And they there's something very optimistic about them. So it was, you know, really a pleasure to have that in rehearsal. And also the fact that the dog owners are, some of them, a couple of them are dancers, but most of them are not. They're just people who I met at the dog park or who heard about the piece and wanted to be in it. So there's that kind of everyday pedestrian quality to it that I also, you know, for me, it's just about what getting through everyday life is.
Kimi Okada's work is going to be performed at the Mission Creek Park as part of San Francisco Trolley Dances. Mm-hmm. Kim, obviously some great care is taken with the spots that you chose for each of these routes. What particular spot stands out to you saying, oh my gosh, I've got to do something in this space this time around?
Well, it's more how do I carve it from where I begin and where I end, and how long is that ride, and what do I find of interest in that neighborhood? So that's when I've been to the park, Mission Creek, a few times, and I always thought, oh, this is so beautiful riding on the water, because it's very hard to get sites on the water. It's usually very expensive permits along the Embarcadero. So I worked with the park, and we figured it out. And it was just, I thought, oh, people will love this. They can hang out in the park. They can see dance. It's a beautiful place to begin. So once I knew I had that, then I find the other things that I think of are of interest in that area, like Mercy Housing. They're all over the city working with seniors to have nice places to live. And then on the other side of the creek, there was a potential for having a site. And then I go and I say, well, what's a good route and where do I want to land? So I wanted to go back to some sites we had done before. So Robert Moses Kinn is actually in a site that I did the first year of Trolley Dances. And then Jess Alito from Steamroller, he was in Maiden Lane the first year. And this year he's in Natoma on these sort of this mural. And he's redoing a piece he had done about gay marriage. And so he's translating that. So I also thought about what can I bring back that would be interesting and how would it change? And then what is the pathway and the least really amount of walking? Because it's a two-hour tour and it can be tiring. And then once I knew I could get into SF MoMA, which we're really excited about, that's my site, and I'm working with Stephen Kent, where the Richard Serra sculpture is on the Howard Street entrance. Mm-hmm. So they're dancing on all those big wooden steps.
Wow.
So it's really just, it sort of comes together. It's not necessarily always easy. I might get something and lose something mm-hmm. along that journey because mm-hmm. it's a lot for a site to take on, you know, us being in there, dancing, rehearsing, bringing audiences.
Insurance.
Insurance.
Yeah, you've used a word that I want to focus on, landing, because a lot of these, or at least some of the works that are being done, are practically Cirque du Soleil quality. I mean, there's an aerial component of them, aren't there, mm-hmm. in terms of the space. You're using not just the ground.
No. We use everything, that's for sure. I always say if my sneakers could talk, you know, how do you really get in and meet a neighborhood? And that's a big part of it, is meeting the people that live there and then what art groups are there. Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited for everybody to come October 20th and 21st. And the meeting place is 4th and Channel, right at Mission Creek Park. It's not far from the Caltrans station. It's also where the N and the T go right there. Mm-hmm. And lots of buses.
Admission is free, but with the cost of a Muni ticket, or I guess you could use your Clipper card, right?
You can use your Clipper card, absolutely. And we sell those to people that don't have them at the table, so we don't have to slow down getting on and off, because we want to work with the conductors that are running the trains.
Sure. Each tour runs about 2 hours. It's next Saturday and Sunday, mm-hmm. 11 a.m., 11:45, 12:30, 1:15, 2, and 2:45. It starts at Mission Creek Park. Grab your Muni card and head over there next Saturday or Sunday.
2021.
And you can learn more about the different companies involved at epiphanydance.org.
Yes.
Kimi Okada, Kim Epifano, always a pleasure having you back. Kim, we'll talk again.
Thank you for having us.
Keep us informed of your next works. Here's some music from Kimi Okada's work that you'll see at Mission Creek Park. You'll hear at Mission Creek Park as part of Kimi Okada's contribution to SF Trolley Dances this next week in the 20th and 21st. Information once again at epiphanydance.org. Good afternoon once again. I'm David LaTulipe, and you're listening to Open Air here on KALW San Francisco, your local public radio station, listener-supported here in the Bay Area. Thank you for your contributions that make everything we do here possible. I'm pleased to welcome Monique Jenkinson, who is a multifaceted performer who has created and performed both locally and around the world. Her drag queen alter ego, Phonique, is a prolific fixture on the experimental performance scene, getting her start at the legendary weekly San Francisco nightclub Tranny Shack and making history as the first woman to win the infamous Miss Tranny Shack pageant. She is spent 5 years as a co-director with actor Kevin Clark of the performing arts duo Hagen and Simone, and is a current artist in residence at ODC Theater. Welcome to you, Monique.
Hello.
And she's
lovely to be here.
Happy to have you. She's joined by her partner in life and stage, Mark I'm sorry, I didn't catch your last name.
Kate.
Mark Kate, a composer whose electronic score accompanies Monique's show Girl, which runs at the Joe Good Annex this and next weekend. Welcome to you, Mark.
Thank you very much.
So you're turning some basic definitions on its ear in my book. I always thought that drag meant a man performing as a woman, or I guess there's a similar equivalent for a woman performing as a man, but you are a woman performing as a woman.
Yes.
And it's you're still calling it drag. How is
We're
that possible?
We're calling it drag. Well, I would say actually that I'm not a woman performing as a woman, but as I am a performer, a cisgender woman performing as a drag queen,
okay.
Which I think if you look at drag queens and drag aesthetic, and we've certainly seen a proliferation of drag aesthetics in the world with the popularity of RuPaul's Drag Race, et cetera, lately, and you look at a lot of those queens, those drag queens, and they're not necessarily imitating women. They're not embodying. They're embodying a kind of amplified version of the feminine, which is what I see a drag queen as. She's another creature entirely. Women, cisgender women, don't necessarily go around in the world looking like drag queens. And so I don't think that drag queens necessarily are imitating women at this point,
okay.
but you know, embodying this other kind of creature.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm doing as Phonique.
Oh, nice.
And just to say as well that the piece that is premiering tonight is a full collaboration between myself and Mark Kate. So we've both created this piece together.
Mm, nice. Mark Kate, tell us a little bit about the music that is being used in this production.
It is a combination of improvisation and pre-recorded music that I've made that draws from a bit from horror movie soundtracks, but more from horror itself. So rather than pick up on the way horror movie scores through the ages has sort of cued us in the middle of, you know, say a really chilling moment in a scary movie, rather than drawing from that, but just draw from the actual tension that is created in these films.
So let's talk then, Monique, about the story, the through line for this. Horror tropes are being involved. You're also exploring feminism for in a certain way?
I am, yes. We are, I should say. So the work is called Girl, and what we're doing is using horror tropes. It's not necessarily a narrative. I would say maybe it's, you know, I would call it anti-narrative, but not fully abstract. This piece, it uses dance, it uses filmic modes, horror tropes, to explore this idea of the final girl, which is an archetype coined by a writer, Carol J. Clover, who works out of Berkeley, I think, still. And she wrote a book called Men, Women, and Chainsaws in the early 90s, which was a kind of the seminal reading of feminism and horror. And I'll let Mark talk a little more about that, actually.
Yeah, she wrote this book, Men, Women, and Chainsaws, and really attempted to explore the history of horror films, especially focusing on the slasher film, which is this very reduced type of structure. Almost all slasher films are the same, and they're all, generally speaking, one killer, a lot of teenage girls, and a lot of death. But the key to most slasher films is, almost without exception, there's one young woman who survives to the end, which she refers to as the final girl. And the book Men, Women, and Chainsaws explores a lot of territory in horror, but key to it is this question of, okay, all these teenage boys in the 80s flocking to the theaters to see slasher films and watch these female protagonists who survive. So these teenage boys are being asked to be empathetic, to identify with these teenage girl victim survivors. What's happening? Why is that the case? Almost no other films have women as protagonists, almost without fail. Even still, Hollywood still doesn't really focus too much on women's stories. But horror films are almost all female protagonist led.
Safe to say, Monique, that you are the final girl in this production.
Among other things, I represent the final girl. I mean, we're working a little bit, too, with the ideas of the monstrous feminine. You know, some of these, a lot of these archetypes that come up through horror. But yes, so this is sort of the feminist lens that we're taking. And indeed, this piece is a continuation of the feminist arc of my work that my work has kind of been on for the past few years.
So it's not only sung vocals that you'll be doing, but there's also a dance element involved?
There's a dance element. There's sung vocals. There's speaking. We've written stories and kind of poetic pieces and what else? Some surprises.
I would say if you're familiar with especially like Bay Area-based dance, the number of things that happen within this dance context are no surprise, right?
Exactly. It's dance, but it's not limited to dance, but it's happening in the context of dance.
Well, just from the looks of the press release, the costuming is also fabulous.
It is.
It's pretty epic.
Yeah,
tell us about how you designed or contributed to the design of these.
Well, I don't know that I want to reveal. We have a thing in drag parlance, which is we like to talk about the reveal. So this happens in drag, and you see it in burlesque as well, where, you know, something happens, something turns into something else. Transformation becomes a theme, and that's something that is material in the costumes. So I don't want to reveal the reveal.
Okay.
maybe I'll say the costume is also the set.
Yes.
Ah, okay. Very intriguing.
Exactly. Exactly.
Is this a show that you hope to, that has legs? Are you going to take it to other places?
I sure hope so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm Canadian, so I'm seeing if Canada has any extra money kicking around that America seems to not any longer for touring grants and stuff.
For touring, although we did get some nice funding for the development
of it.
So we must thank the Kenneth Rainin Foundation, actually, and the Zellerbach Family Foundation. I mean, it's really important. I think these organizations contribute so much to the creation of art. And, of course, Joe Good Performance Group, who's given us this amazing residency and this production support. So we're the inaugural production of Joe Good Performance Group's producing platform.
Great. Very nice.
Yes.
And tonight, I hear, is sold out. There might be some tickets available at the door. You might take a chance there. But it runs a Thursday through Saturday this weekend and next.
Yes.
At the Joe Good Annex, which is on Alabama Street. Monique Jenkinson as Phonique with electronic composer Mark Kate, their collaboration girl. Mark, we're going to hear a bit of your soundtrack going out. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Of course, wish you a great performance, and it sounds really both fascinating and fabulous.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a touch of the soundscape from Girl. That's electronic soundscape created by Mark Kate. Will be part of the accompaniment to Monique Jenkinson's embodiment of Phonique at the Joe Good Annex, 401 Alabama Street here in San Francisco. This weekend and next. Tonight sold out. Maybe a standby ticket available.
And welcome back to Open Hour. My guest today, Paul Muldoon, who's currently teaching at Princeton, but of course is leading the whole brigade in this great Irish festivity happening here down in Los Gatos. But I thought what we'd do to start with, Paul, is speak a little bit about some of the poems in the selected volume. That's the ones written between 1968 and 2014. And I know you are friendly with Seamus Heaney. Can we speak a little bit about your relationship with him?
Sure. I met him in fact, 1968. I was a student. I was 16 at the time, and he came to read, along with Michael Longley and another friend of theirs, David Hammond, in the Armagh County Museum. And I was introduced to him there by one of my school teachers. And he was very generous to me, helped me get published. He's, published me some of my poems in a magazine that he was editing and helped me, get published by Faber's, for example, the main English poetry publisher. And he was also my teacher briefly at Queen's University Belfast. And indeed, early on, I remember he took a year off to come over here to Berkeley. He was teaching here, and we had some correspondence at that stage about the Indians on Alcatraz, the Native American takeover of Alcatraz, which interested us both very much. But basically, he was a great force in my life and the life of many others, and an all-round good guy.
Yeah, I definitely found that the warmth of his poetry was not just on the printed page, but it was particularly when he spoke the lines himself. There was something that drew you in if you were listening.
And I think that's right. He was a very charismatic character. So I actually dedicated a poem to it. It's a poem to him, a poem written while I was living in New York about 30 years ago. And I was teaching at Columbia, as it happens, at the time, as well as Princeton. And I used to head across town with a little plastic carrier bag with my bits and pieces in it. And my father-in-law decided that this was not appropriate for me. And so he gave me a present of a briefcase made from, it was covered with eel skin. Mm-hmm. And it was purple, and a very gaudy affair altogether. Not really the sort of thing that one should have been carrying through the streets of New York, certainly not 30 years ago. It was a slightly dicey place. But in any case, so I partly because of Seamus Heaney's use of eel imagery in a number of his poems, I dedicated it to him, the briefcase. Mm-hmm. I held the briefcase at arm's length from me. The ox blood or liver eel skin with which it was covered had suddenly grown supple. I'd been waiting in line for the cross-town bus when an almighty cloudburst left the sidewalk a raging torrent. And though it contained only the first inkling of this poem, I knew I daren't set the briefcase down to slap my pockets for an obol, for fear it might slink into a culvert and strike out along the East River for the sea, by which I mean the open sea. And the obol, of course, is the little coin or token, transport token in this case, that one would pay the ferryman crossing the Styx.
So is the briefcase still around?
The briefcase is still around. In the poem, of course, I was interested in it sort of reverting to its eeldom. You know, the eel is a very, very powerful force in the world. And indeed, one hears stories of wallets made of eel skin, mm-hmm. That have within them still the power to demagnetize credit cards. Because one of the ways in which the eel functions in the world as it crosses vast tracts of the Atlantic from the Sargasso Sea to Europe, for example, is it guides itself, as do many animals, by magnetism, with a sense of the where the
kind of an electric eel.
Well, it is, yes. I mean, it's not an electric eel in the strictest sense, but it's using some of that technology.
And eels are one of those curious creatures. If you go to the East End of London, eel pie is a very basic dish. And then you go to Poland, it becomes a high luxury item.
You know, in Northern Ireland, where both Seamus and I were from, of course, Loch Ness is the central large lake up there, and it's one of the main eel fishery areas in the world. And indeed, you know, I don't know if I ever ate an eel. I might have eaten an eel once in when I lived in Northern Ireland. Many of those eels, of course, are exported to the West End, East End of London, where they were considered a delicacy.
And in fact, a friend of mine got a company going where he would transport them and came up with the catchy title, Eels on Wheels.
That's a great title. That's a perfect rhyme there. It's a little couplet in itself.
It's a couplet by itself, indeed.
And it says a lot about our impulse in life as children and as beyond childhood to delight in those chimes. You know, the eel wheel nexus actually makes us happy. Mm-hmm. We enjoy that.
In fact, talking of childhood memories, there's another poem you have. I think it's called Symposium. And it reminds me of an Irish aunt of mine who would be just a mistress of clichés. And she would take a cliché, as good as the day is long, and she would turn it around and let it rest. And I think I found that in one of your poems.
Well, there's a poem called Symposium, perhaps, that is particularly relevant there, I think. You know, even as I was reading The Briefcase, I realize in the midst of it there are two phrases, almighty cloudburst and raging torrent. And really, if you think about it, you don't have to think about it too long. Those are both clichés.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we function by cliché. It's one of the things that helps us get through. Of course, in the poetry business, we're encouraged not to resort, as it were, to cliché. We're meant to be making it new and reinventing and re-ventilating the language. But from time to time, it can be very useful in a poem, too. And indeed, this particular poem takes a series of truisms, proverbs, well-known phrases and sayings. It takes half of one and it violently rams it up against half of another. And it's often, of course, in those moments where disparate, heterogeneous ideas, to use that description of how John Donne, the great poet, works, heterogeneous ideas yoked by violence together. A symposium, of course, is a technical term, as you know, for a philosophical conversation. And at its root, there's the idea that a glass of wine, or perhaps a couple of glasses of wine, are enjoyed. So this is a poem in which maybe several more than two have been enjoyed. It's slightly crazy, slightly tipsy. Symposium. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it hold its nose to the grindstone and hunt with the hounds. Every dog has a stitch in time. Two heads, you've been sold one good turn. One good turn deserves a bird in the hand. A bird in the hand is better than no bread. To have your cake is to pay Paul. Make hay while you can still hit the nail on the head. For want of a nail, the sky might fall. People in glass houses can't see the wood for the new broom. Rome wasn't built between two stools. Empty vessels wait for no man. A hair of the dog is a friend indeed. There's no fool like the fool who shot his bolt. There's no smoke after the horse is gone.
Well, that's just beautiful. It got me thinking about people in glass houses shouldn't make love.
Yeah. Well, you know, the problem with a poem like this, actually, is that when you go down this road, you know, the whole world begins to fall into it. And, in fact, I've just written another poem, which, I don't know if I should have allowed myself to go down that road, which is uses a similar technique and takes a bit of one proverb and sticks it up against another. The problem with it is it's kind of addictive. It's such good fun. And probably one shouldn't be having so much fun when one's writing a serious poem.
Oh, sure, you should be.
That's the thing. I mean, I am very much a believer in poetry that, you know, in the midst of being serious about the world and maybe even sometimes being solemn about the world, you know, you have to have a bit of crack, yeah, as we call it.
A joke is a very serious thing.
Well, it is, absolutely. Yeah. It truly is.
Now, before we go on to one more, I do want to introduce Catherine Berry, who's with us today. And we're going to go back to Paul in a second to hear the poem Truce, but let's hear a little bit about the Irish Festival and where it's happening and the whole range, because I know it literally begins tomorrow, or tonight, in fact, Thursday night.
Good afternoon, Peter. Thank you very much. My name is Catherine Berry. I'm the founder and director of the Irish Writers Festival. So it's such an honour to have Mr. Muldoon with us, one of our big headliners this weekend on a rare West Coast visit, I believe. Paul will be in UC Berkeley tonight and tomorrow night at our opening reception at Montalvo Arts Centre with another big fella, Fintan O'Toole, an Irish Times columnist.
Brilliant, brilliant man. I love him dearly.
And he is really here with a couple of hats too. He's doing something at the World Affairs Council tonight talking about Brexit. And he's also promoting his book about George Bernard Shaw alongside an exhibit we will have at Montalvo Arts Centre. So it's going to be a great opening evening. Still tickets available for that.
And you've got music and you've got art as well.
We've got music. We have a little bit of a theme of 21st century Irish. So we have we have to get rid of the shamrocks and leprechauns around here a little bit.
And even a talk on Frederick Douglass coming to Ireland, which people may not know about.
That's right. Who knew? I didn't know about it. And a lot of Irish people didn't know Frederick Douglass was in Ireland, if you didn't read the Colin McCann
book.
And
what's the website to reach?
It's irishwriterslosgatos.com. Okay. And an irishartsfestival.com gets us there as well. And we have an interesting trio of events on Saturday, Bullets, Bells and Blues, with an anthology of poetry that was written after Newtown Park school shooting. Essayist and poet Gerald Daw, who's written about Van Morrison's Belfast, and Van Morrison's daughter Shanna will be joining us with music.
And so just to finish, I'm going to ask Paul if he would read Truce, which is a particularly pertinent poem, speaks about everything we often think about Ireland. Paul, can we go back to you for now?
Well, indeed. I mean, it's of course there was a famous truce, and there continues to be a truce in the country. Though the truce that's referred to here most immediately is actually at the truce that occurred during the first Christmas of the First World War, when, you know, despite, I suppose, the wishes of the high command and indeed the officers, the men on the ground who were fighting each other, German and British soldiers, including, by the way, many Irish soldiers, got together in no man's land and had a party. This poem was written in the, I'd say, 1978-79. Of course, I don't mean 1878, it's a kind of love poem, I suppose, because that, in fact, is really what we're talking about. And I'm a believer, in my innocence, perhaps, that love is, and I think we're in the right part of the world to believe this. We have to believe it, despite all the evidence to the contrary, and there's plenty of that love conquers all. Truce. It begins with one or two soldiers and one or two following with hampers over their shoulders. They might be off wild fowling, as they would another Christmas day. So gingerly they pick their steps. No one seems sure of what to do. All stop when one stops. A fire gets lit. Some spread their greatcoats on the frozen ground. Polish vodka, fruit and bread are broken out and passed round. The air of an old German song, the rules of patience, are the secrets they'll share before long. They draw on their last cigarettes as Friday night lovers, when it's over, might get up from their mattresses to congratulate each other and exchange names and addresses.
Well, that's just beautiful. So thank you again, Paul, for coming in. I know
it's a pleasure to be here. I'm thrilled to be part of this festival and to be here with you.
And the festival is happening down at Las Gatas. And again, thank you, Catherine, for being with us.
Thank you, Peter.
And if you want to give us the website one more time?
IrishArtsFestival.com.
Good. Thank you.
And thank you, Peter Robinson, for that contribution and conversation. The festival takes place in Las Gatas, October 12th to 14th, with additional events in Berkeley and San Francisco on the 11th and in Oakland on the 15th. The 11th, that's today. A couple of weeks ago, I had a conversation with conductor Michael Morgan of the Oakland Symphony. We talked about a wide range of things, including the opening concert of the Oakland Symphony's new season, which is tomorrow evening at the Paramount Theater in Oakland. Three dance episodes from On the Town, a touch of which you're hearing in the background, featured on the program. Also, the Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto No. 2 in C minor, featuring Stuart Goodyear at the piano, and Dmitri Shostakovich's amazing Symphony No. 5. Speaking of Shostakovich, oh, look, by the way, that concert is tomorrow at 8 at the Paramount Theater, oaklandsymphony.org for more information. Speaking of Shostakovich, do join me, David Latuli, for Explorations in Music. Now, Mondays at 9 p.m. through the end of November, the Alexander String Quartet and Robert Greenberg offer some interesting insights and incredible playing and exploring the string quartets of Dmitri Shostakovich. That's Monday evening at 9. I'm your host for that show. Thanks for listening to Open Air. I should say that next week we have an interesting lineup. The incoming artistic director, Eric Dudley, of the San Francisco Contemporary Music Players. I'll also talk with conductor Pablo Haras Casado, who returns to the San Francisco Symphony next week. Comedian Marga Gomez stops by to talk about Latin standards, her latest and last work in the solo performance genre. And actor Robert Grunwald will also talk about his interesting, riveting one-person drama, The Obligation. That's next week on Open Air. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. It's there you can also send me a note and perhaps let me know someone you'd like to hear on Open Air. The show is produced by Neil Swinkles. Thanks always to Neil's for herding cats and keeping the calendar clean and updated. Again, our shows are archived at kalw.org. Thanks for listening. See you again next week.